For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, the audiobook show from RNIB. I'm your host Red Sail, and this week we've got a special episode celebrating the best of the Costa Book Awards. This annual prize is unique in recognising some of the most enjoyable books published in the past year, across five categories. And as you'll know if you've tuned into our last couple of shows, Read On has been on hand to bring you interviews with all of this year's category winners. But there could only be one overall winner, and the judges revealed the decision at a ceremony in London on Tuesday evening. In a minute, we'll bring you an interview with the winning author, after which Robert Kirkwood is on hand to take us back through some of the highlights of this most popular of British literary awards. So get yourself a cuppa, sit back and enjoy this Read On retrospective. Of all the literary prizes that we cover each year for Read On, the Costa Awards is the one that I look forward to most. Selecting any title from the shortlist pretty much guarantees you a good read. And with five category winners to choose from, it also gives me a range of gift ideas that covers all my family and friends for the year ahead. And this year was a cracker. I loved all five titles in contention. But it was a competition, so there had to be a winner. And I'm delighted to say that the winner of this year's Costa Book of the Year Award is Hannah Lowe, for her poetry collection, The Kids. Hannah Lowe, congratulations on winning the Costa Book of the Year Award.
Thank you very much. I'm utterly over the moon, delighted, surprised, amazed, wonderful.
Hasn't quite sunk in yet.
Not really, no, but there's such lovely news.
The Kids is a collection of sonnets inspired by your 10 years of teaching sometimes reluctant sick formers the joys of English literature, and sonnets were on that curriculum. Is that why you chose to write a collection of sonnets?
Yeah, I wouldn't say it emerged exactly like that, but I love form. And in my previous books, I've been experimenting with different forms as well. But there's several sonnets in my first collection. So I love the sonnet form. I love form because it pushes your imagination to new places that you wouldn't necessarily reach when you're trying to find a rhyme or a metrical line or whatever it is. But as the poems began to emerge, I began to realise that it was the perfect form for what I was writing about. Because, yeah, I did have to teach the sonnet and Shakespeare, you know, who's probably the best known sonneteer, over and over again for years. And sometimes, you know, the kids would be asking, but we know why iambic pentameter? Why does it matter? Why do these rhyme schemes matter? And then as I began to kind of carry on writing the poems, I began to see that the shape of the sonnet on the page, the little square, sort of resembled a classroom. And so many of the poems were about classroom encounters. I thought it sort of looked like a blackboard. It looks like the little page of a book, you know, which is my material. So it just seemed the form was right. And once you've got, you know, I tried to write them all as a crown first, with the end line of each sonnet is the first line of the next one. And I got about 30 poems into that before realising it wasn't going to work. It was quite devastating. And then when I began to see that actually, okay, this can work as separate sonnets, by then I had 30 or 35. And at that point, I thought to myself, well, come on, you've got to plough on. It's like running a marathon. I'm going to finish off.
I remember trying to write sonnets in my English A-level classes and thinking they were so difficult. And in some ways, they just seemed like the elite poems of the poetry world. But you've done a huge amount to democratise them, to make them relevant to teenagers.
Yeah, well, I suppose I was thinking, you know, in some of the sonnets that I was teaching, kind of more canonical sonnets, I could see what the kids were thinking. Why do I care about someone who loves someone that doesn't love them back in 1830? So part of the energy of the book is about, you know, putting those kids with all their, you know, their wit, their humour, their language, their slang, their complexity, to put them down on paper. Yeah, I wanted them to be the subject of a form that is traditionally considered to be high art and elitist. That was part of my thinking, you know, what I could do with the form as well. I hope I've to some degree achieved that.
Well, they're immensely accessible, not least because in parts they're very funny and they're also very poignant. And part of the humour is you are brave enough to laugh at yourself, which is another great lesson for us all to learn.
Yeah, no one's put it to me like that. But yeah, I think I am naturally self-deprecating in the kind of British tradition of a very dry, self-deprecating person. I definitely fit into that mould. But you know what I also think? I think you probably wouldn't be able to laugh at yourself. I wouldn't have been able to have laughed at myself in my early days of teaching. Because then I thought I had to be the fountain of all knowledge and, oh God, please don't ask me a question that I'm not going to be able to find the answer to. And, you know, it's only as I've become more confident in my knowledge and also in what I don't know, that I can say I don't know something, but I can find out, or that ask a student, you find out and tell me next week. That was where I was able to laugh at myself. And some of the things that happened in the class, I mean, there were so many things that didn't go into the book. I mean, it's constantly funny, my experience of teaching, because I was so often being caught out with not knowing. I didn't have an English degree, and I was teaching English literature, so that was one of the, you know, I had an American literature degree, but I didn't know the canon, so I was having to teach myself in order to teach them, and that, yeah, it resulted in, you know, some quite amusing happenings.
And that sense that we are learning all the way through our lives underpins all the poems, but especially the ones where you're dealing with motherhood and also looking back at your own education, just realizing that you don't always have all the answers, but you can learn and it can be joyful learning.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think maybe because I, relatively late in my life, I took on a new learning experience, and that was to learn about writing poetry. And so I've had that several experiences in my life of like really going at something with tenacity. I'm sure that like loads of people, you know, anyone that's supposed to learn an instrument, a musical instrument, and has gone quite far with that, or anyone that's been engaged in a sport and got better at that, or even just like, you know, you can't swim front crawl and then you practice and practice and practice and then you can. I've had lots of experiences like that in my life. And I didn't start writing poetry until I was 28. And then I did workshop after workshop and course after course, and I just loved learning again. I hated the idea that my life as a learner had ended, you know, which is one of the things I think, maybe you come out of university or wherever you finish your education thinking, oh, that's it now, I'm full. But I'm still not full. So I was thinking the other day, oh, am I ever going to get any good at the guitar? I still take it down off the wardrobe some way.
Well, on past evidence, I'll be waiting for your number one album next year, Hannah, I think.
It ain't going to happen. No way. It's not going to happen. I'm trying to get better at yoga now. That's my thing. That's the thing I think I've got a bit of promise.
You join a handful of very illustrious poets who've won the Costa or its predecessor, the Whitbread Prize. How do you feel about your poems being taught to students alongside the likes of Ted Hughes and Seamus Heaney?
Oh my God. I'm like, are you kidding me? I mean, it's an amazing honour. And, you know, I hope my poems can bring something to the table. I think that, you know, God, I was thinking about Seamus Heaney's sonnet, Postscript, one of my very favourite poems, which is a beautiful sonnet. And the idea that any of my sonnets could sit alongside his sonnet is just amazing. And also, you know, Ted Hughes, very complicated writer, and people have lots of different views about him. But a book like Birthday Letters, which I think is such a wonderful collection of poetry that's really about trying to make sense of your life through poems. And in that case, it makes sense of a relationship and a reflecting back on a time. I suppose that's what I try to do in the kids as well. I'm not saying I should be compared to Ted Hughes, but I get the energy of the endeavours of some of those poems for sure. And I hope that, I think I've been influenced by them as well.
Now, you're going to be coming down to the RNIB Talking Book Studios later this month to record a talking book version for us, aren't you?
I am, and I'm so excited about that. I mean, not least because I just really believe that poems are meant to be read aloud. So, you know, that's how I edit them. I edit them through speaking them, and poetry, it's so close to song. So it seemed to me like wonderful that it's going to be a kind of audible book and therefore reach a a bigger audience of people that aren't able to read it on the page. I'm delighted, looking forward to it.
Well, I can't wait. So I hope that we can meet up, have a chat and a cup of coffee when you come down.
That'd be really nice. And we could talk about cold water swimming.
Indeed.
I'm also learning. I'm learning how to keep warm afterwards.
Another passion that we share. Well, in the meantime, I hope you enjoy the party. And thank you so much for taking a couple of minutes to come and talk to us. And huge, huge congratulations, Hannah Lowe, on winning this year's Costa Book of the Year Award.
Thanks so much, Red. Sending you my best wishes and see you soon.
And Hannah Lowe will be back to close the show with the books of her life. But for now, it's over to Robert Kirkwood.
The Costa Book Awards are a set of awards recognising English language books by writers based in Britain and Ireland. They started in 1971, known as the Whitbread Book Awards, until 2006 when Costa Coffee, which was then a subsidiary of Whitbread, took over the sponsorship. The awards have always informed RNIB Talking Books as to what books they should be recording. And RNIB Connect Radio got involved with the awards 10 years ago, when we spoke to winner of the Best Novel and the Costa Book of the Year overall, Hilary Mantel. She joined me down the line to talk about Bring Up the Bodies.
His children are falling from the sky. He watches from horseback, acres of England stretching behind him. They drop, gilt-winged, each with a blood-filled gaze. Grace Cromwell hovers in thin air. She is silent when she takes her prey, silent as she glides to his fist.
Now, I've heard you say that Bring Up the Bodies was a much harder book to write than Wolf Hall. Was part of that difficulty because the previous book had won the Booker and there was perhaps a little more pressure on you this time?
It was more difficult only in the writing itself. It took more out of me. It was much more intense. It wasn't technically more difficult. It was only difficult in the wear and tear on the emotions. And I have to say, really, when you sit down to write and you're deeply immersed in a project, the last thing you're thinking about is prizes. In my experience, you're only thinking about your material. So I wasn't at any point in writing that book thinking, I wonder how this will do. I was only concentrating on getting my story told and seeing my characters through to their various end points.
Now, you mentioned there the word intense, and there's certainly a much more intense period of time in this book.
Yes. Wolf Hall is a big sprawling book, and the action covers 30 years, and even more because it goes back into prehistory, into myth, to look at the myths about how Britain began. But Bring Up the Body, which starts where Wolf Hall leaves off in the September of 1535, it covers only a 9-month span. And of that 9 months, the last half of the book covers about 3 weeks as the events lead up to the climax of the execution of Anne Boleyn.
Now, we know it leads up to that execution. Do you think it's strange that everyone knows the ending to this book apart from the characters in the book?
Yes. What I try to do is to put the reader in the same imaginative plane as the characters, so the reader doesn't perceive it as inevitable, but the reader sees the turning points that caused history to work out the way it did.
Now, what do you prefer writing about? The light areas that are well documented in history, or the dark areas of these times that we know nothing about?
I suppose with the light areas, then you think, well, a thing may be well documented, but there may be versions of that documentation. There may be gaps in that documentation. There may be documents that should exist but don't exist. You have something to hang on to. But even with an event that appears to be well documented, you're saying, who's telling me this? why do they want me to believe this? Is there another version told from another point of view? And where are the gaps? And so, in some respects, if you approach all documentation and all of what we refer to as recorded history in that same spirit of skepticism, then in some ways the difference between the light and the dark areas vanishes, because what you see is the shadow behind the light. And so there is really nothing I take for granted beyond, you know, those established days in the calendar on which the axe fell. We often know what happened, but it's the why. That's what I'm dealing in. And every why is dappled with both the light and the dark.
Do you think she, Anne Boleyn, sorry, was guilty of adultery?
No, I think she probably wasn't. But that doesn't mean that I see her as a victim. I think it was a fact that she was not a victim. She was a political player, and she was a big player on the political scene, and she went into battle and she lost. I don't think she herself would have liked to be seen as a victim. Having said that, I know that she was living her life against the backdrop of a culture that was misogynistic. It was an easy accusation to fling against a woman, and utterly destructive. The idea of a queen who broke her marriage vows, because what you're saying here is a queen who could put an illegitimate child on the throne of England, a queen who could pull the wool over a nation's eyes. Any accusation of that type levelled against Anne came very near the question of national security. There's a very fine line there between adultery and treason. I think that although we will never know, I think the probability was that she was sitting up. But she had created the climate in which that could occur. You cannot imagine how the same mechanism could have been used to destroy Henry's first queen, Catherine of Aragon. He simply couldn't. She was above reproach. That's not to say that it was Anne's fault in any way, but I do think that, you know, she was part of the political scene in which she rose and fell. She was not a doll, she was not a passive victim.
Now, what period will you cover in the next book, The Mirror and the Light?
I will take the story up probably at that moment when Anne Boleyn's head falls, as Thomas Cromwell and his son and his colleagues are walking away from the scaffold. And I will continue till 1540, till Cromwell's own death, on the same scaffold in the Tower of London.
Now, there's definitely only going to be one more book, because you said there was going to be two and then there was three. Do you think there might be a fourth?
No, I think the arc of this one is pretty clear. There is no calamitous event, no central event like the fall of Anne Boleyn. In the first book, everything led to the death of Thomas More. In the second, everything led to the death of Anne Boleyn. In the third, everything leads to the death of Cromwell, which doesn't mean to say it's a story of Cromwell's fall, because it's a story of his rise and rise and rise. But what happens now is that the pattern changes. Instead of working towards one great climax in the action, from now on, every day is more or less a crisis for Cromwell. There are no downtimes. There are no quiet times. There is no prospect of reflection or recollection or ease. He's living in an intensely pressurized environment, watching his enemies grouping, sometimes defeating them, but then finally not defeating them.
And when do you think we'll see the final book?
Well, now, about that, I'm making no predictions. Works are fictional, inherently unpredictable, which is why my one book turned into two and my two into three. But I intend to work on it very hard next year. As far as I can, I'm pushing other commitments aside. Already they are creeping into my diary, things that can't be helped. But I do hope to spend the bulk of that year concentrating, and at the end of it I will see where I get. I wouldn't like it to be later than 2015.
And as you know, we had to wait a little longer than that for The Mirror and the Light. On today's Read On, we're having a retrospective look at the Costa Book Awards. In 2012, Hilary Mantel won for Bring Up the Bodies, and in 2014, Best Novel was Ali Smith's How to Be Both. Ali joined me in the Talking Book studio, and after we discussed just how bad each other's cold was, she told me about the book.
It's in two parts, and you can't tell which one of the parts you're going to get first, so whichever book you will pick up will have one part first or the other part first, and it's random. So the book is written so as to be able to do that swivel thing where one half can come first or can come last. At least that's the plan. So it's a book that works on an immediate level of a kind of randomness of whichever bit of a story you come across first comes first. But it might have been the other way around, so the whole time you're with this book you think, oh, it could have been someone else. I know there's another version of this possible, it's just at the back of your head, that's the idea. And because I was looking for a way to, you know, I'd been reading this fantastic Portuguese writer called José Saramago, and in one of Saramago's novels, a novel called The Stone Raft, he laments the fact that when you're a writer, when you write stories, when you write narrative, even when you just write a sentence, one thing has to come after another. A word has to follow a word, has to follow a word, and a thing that happens has to follow a thing that happens, has to follow a thing that happens. And he's complaining in this novel. He says, okay, so a man sits down, another man stands up, a woman drags a dog along the beach, another woman throws a stone into the water, all these things happen simultaneously. But if you're a writer, you can't make them happen simultaneously. They have to all happen one after the other. And he's like, he's furious in his book. He's like, why can't we be like opera singers and make it all happen at the same time, all sing over each other? But we can't, he says. So I was intrigued by this, and I was looking for a form or a way to talk about the ways in which things happen simultaneously. And then I was getting interested in fresco structure, the structure of painting. And fresco is a form of painting where the painter paints directly onto wet plaster that's just been stuck over a wall, and before the plaster dries he has to, or she has to, make the picture. And then when the plaster dries, then this picture will last longer than pictures that have been done on dry plaster, but it becomes a part of the wall. But for people who were restoring those pictures, which are on the surfaces and are actually part of the wall, they found that if they peeled these layers of plaster off the wall, they would find this other story, you know, this other version, this first picturing, you know, done by the artist who was planning out his picture underneath. And it just struck me as the most fantastic metaphor for, well, not just narrative, but life, really, which is that there's one thing on the surface and there might be another thing below it, and we have to find a way to hold them both, even though we might not be able to apprehend or to understand one of the ones because it's just not that apparent to us. It's not straightforwardly there. So that's, you know, and that's the long way of talking about this book. The other way of talking about it is it's about a painter from the Renaissance, and it's about a girl who's living now, and it's about the ways in which these people who are miles apart, years, centuries apart, lives apart, have something in common.
Now, the audio version, when it's available, do you think the audio version is going to be set in stone, or will there be a way to have that randomness?
With every one of our versions, we're finding a way to have the randomness. With the audio version, you'll probably hear a voice saying, which one would you like? Click on this or choose this, and then you'll be able to choose, you know, one of the options, and it'll come to you. So what we've been working on in all the versions, and in fact it's been most simple in the print version, and I presume it'd be the same in the Braille version, which is that it's very simply done. You just simply swap the file and change the form, and then you produce the book. But I think with the audio version, what we'll be doing is there'll be a button, and you'll get a choice, but the choice will still leave you with, you know, the randomness of coming across a story.
Yeah. Well, it'll be a different voice for George, right, and for Francesco's parts.
I don't know. What we were talking about with that was that I think they should all have the same voice, since it's all the same story, all the same book. So, and then there was a discussion of, which is also, there's a gender question in this book, so there was also a question about whether or not we would have a woman's voice or a man's voice, or two women's voices and two men's voices. And I said simply, I don't mind what the gender is, just, you know, I think we should have one person who reads both parts.
Certainly if there's any ambiguity about gender, it should be a female voice, I think, because female voices...
Do you think?
Yes, I think female voices can be more gender neutral, especially since You get female voices doing the voices of like Bart Simpson and the boy characters in there.
That's true. So you can get a kind of upper and a lower register. But you know, I've heard male voices which can do. Here we're back to opera again. I've heard male voices which see, there we go. We're in the right place. I've heard male voices that can do both. That can, you know, sound very kind of placed and authoritative, and then the next moment sounds quite something else, something that has been lightened and has changed dimension. So I think the human voice is remarkable. In fact, I think that, you know, this being a book about painting, really, 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 this is really a book about voice. And the surprise of this book to me was that it was actually all about what voice does and where voice, how voice never leaves us, really.
Now, we just talked about audiobooks there. Do you listen to a lot of audiobooks yourself?
I do, actually. I like to listen to them in the car. It's that space in your head which can be filled with a whole story while you're doing something else.
Do you think it changes the experience of reading, having someone read the book to you?
I think it kind of accesses the same way as radio does, the imagination in a way that we have no other way of doing, which is that a voice speaks in our heads and creates a world, and it's a world that we are creating along with the voice, so it's a communal act, but it's a world absolutely of our imaginations, because as the voice tells us, we make the picture, we make the thing happen, we make the world exist, we make the whole, you know, dimensional kind of breadth of it and scope of it in our own heads. And I just think that's the most beautiful thing. It's why I'm drawn to radio as one of the most creative of our of our facilities as in the media world. It's the place where, well, the voice goes straight into the imagination in a way that nothing else does, really.
The best pictures are on the radio.
I think so. I've always believed it. I've always believed that the best, you know, the place where we can access both communality, you know, the agreement to a story with someone else, and our own imaginations is exactly there via the voice.
And how important is it to you that your books are available to everyone, regardless of their disability or their reading ability?
You have no idea how important it is. Tremendously important to me. It goes direct to my heart. I do not want any excludings, and it's one of the reasons that when I write short stories, I write them without gender, because the imagination is not exclusive, our genders are not exclusive, love is not exclusive, and our living worlds are not exclusive, so let's not make any of our arts exclusive. One of my nephews has been blind since he was 4 years old, and he is now an adult, and he lives in a college, and he works and makes things, and is fantastically, he's such an exciting guy, and it's something which, when I was quite young, this happened, he'd lost his sight, and he lost it, he was only, as I say, a child, he had meningitis, lost his sight, and so it really did make a huge difference to all of us, and in a very close way, because a child who has been sighted and then has lost sight, it has, if you like, the best of and the worst of both, because, you know, there's a kind of remaking of yourself in it, and he so remade himself, this boy and this man.
Ali Smith speaking to me back in 2014. The very next year, the overall Costa Book of the Year was won by the best children's book, Frances Harding's The Lie Tree. That was a book Red Sail had never read, until it was suggested he review it for Read On.
The Lie Tree by Frances Harding. Her father disappeared into the throat of the caves, carrying the pot as tenderly as if it were a wounded child. The light receded with him, leaving Faith in darkness. The cave smelt of the sea, but it was not a cheerful seaside smell. It reeked, as if the sea were something old and evil. This sea licked the flesh off shipwrecks, leaving the bare wooden bones in the lightless deep. Its mermaids were green-skinned and squid-eyed, with long, hooked fingers and breath that smelt of old fish. At last, Faith's father returned, carrying nothing but the lantern. He loosed the rope and jumped back into the boat without a word.
Even before it won the 2015 Costa Book of the Year Award, people were telling me to read The Lie Tree by Frances Harding. My daughter loved it, my friends told me it was unputdownable, and the critics lavished it with praise. But somehow I always found myself reading something else first, so I never got round to it. Set in the male-dominated world of Victorian amateur scientists, the book tells the story of 14-year-old Faith Sunderley, who accompanies her father to an archaeological dig on the island of Vane. But he is pursued there by scandal, and when he dies under mysterious circumstances, Faith is left fighting to save his reputation. His journal leads her to a strange tree.
She opened it and began to read the words carefully inscribed in her father's precise, elegant hand. A study of the alleged virtues of the mendacity tree. I first heard of the so-called mendacity tree when on a visit to southern China in 1860. My visit proved ill-timed, and as I was travelling through the Yunnan region, I heard rumours of the fresh conflict between British and Chinese forces. Uncertain where I might meet hostility, I sought accommodation in a riverside village and waited for further news. There, by chance, I made the acquaintance of one Mr. Hector Winterbourne, a fellow natural scientist. He was a veteran of many excavations and a fanatical collector, with a passion for monstrosity and oddity of all sorts. Pleased at the chance of an educated conversation with one of my countrymen, I spoke with him for the greater part of the night. He waxed fervent about his latest obsession, a plant he had encountered in an obscure legend 3 years before. This tree was said to resemble a creeper, but to bear citrus-like fruit, possessed of extraordinary properties. The plant thrived in darkness or muted light, and would only flower or bear fruit if it was fed lies. This I dismissed as plainly fantastical, and was surprised when my companion did not share my scepticism. When I asked him how a plant could be fed a lie, he said that the falsehood needed to be whispered to the tree and then circulated widely. The more important the lie, and the larger the number of people prevailed upon to believe it, the larger the fruit. Should anybody consume that fruit, they would be granted knowledge of a most secret sort, and on a matter close to their heart. Faith stared. Was this a fairy tale? Why had her famously rational father written of such a thing? At the same time, her thoughts slid to the shrouded plant pot her father had been so desperate to conceal.
Hoping the lie tree will show her the truth about her father's death, Faith begins to spread lies about the island's unwelcoming inhabitants. This is a page-turner from the first. There's plenty of suspense with half-heard conversations, intrigue, glimpses of clues, and a sense of lurking menace. Like Faith, the reader knows that something is wrong, but not enough to know exactly what it is. As with all good fictional English villages, Vane is full of suspicious locals. But there's nothing cliched about this book. Both its characters and plot are meticulously drawn, and it's full of fascinating detail about Victorian life and beliefs. The action takes place shortly after Darwin published On the Origin of Species, and like many of his contemporaries, Faith's father is struggling to be both a man of science and a man of God. As a young Victorian woman, Faith struggles merely to have her voice heard. She is only too aware that her dream of becoming a natural scientist is viewed as unnatural by the society she lives in.
Every child begins their life in debt to the parents that house, clothe and feed them. A son may some day pay back that debt by cutting a figure in the world and raising the family's fortunes. As a daughter, you never will. You will never serve with honour in the army, or distinguish yourself in the sciences, or make a name for yourself in the church or parliament, or make a decent living in the professions. You will never be anything but a burden and a drain on my purse. Even when you marry, your dowry will gouge a hole in the family coffers. You speak so scornfully of Howard that if you do not marry, some day you will need to court his charity or find yourself without bed and board.
In clumsier hands, these themes could weigh the plot down. But like all good storytellers, Frances Harding uses them to support and flesh out her characters. Because she's a children's author writing for young adults, she has the freedom to blend genres. So The Lie Tree is part crime thriller, part gothic fantasy, and part Victorian melodrama, and as a result, totally gripping. For me, the hallmark of a good book is wanting to turn the pages to find out what happens next. while at the same time never wanting the story to end. The mark of a great book is that it leaves you satisfied when you do finish it. The Lie Tree did just that. Like the teenage hero and the age of discovery she lives in, this book brims with potential and excitement from beginning to end. And because it is so good at presenting complicated ideas in an accessible and entertaining way, I too will be recommending it to adults and teenagers alike. My only minor criticism is that the version I downloaded had a male narrator. In a book with a female protagonist and women's rights at its heart, this seemed odd. That said, it is very well read, and it made little difference to this brilliant book. The Lie Tree is available in various formats from the RNIB library, including TB number 23014. Other books by Frances Harding also available include Cuckoo Song, TB 21758, and for younger readers, why not try Fly By Night, Harding's prize-winning tale of Mosca Mai and her homicidal goose, Saracen, who travel to the city of Mandalon hot on the heels of smooth-talking conman Eponymous Clent. With a plot like that, what's not to like?
And finally, in this retrospective look at the Costa Book Awards, let's hear about the winner of the Poetry Award from 2018. J.O. Morgan won it for Assurances and was interviewed by Red Sail after the win, and at that point no audio version of it existed. But as a direct result of that interview, J.O. Morgan appeared at the Glasgow Talking Book Studios a few months later to record Assurances. Assurances by J.O. Morgan was the winner of the Costa Poetry Award. A war poem both historic and frighteningly topical, Assurances begins in the 1950s during a period of vigilance and dread in the middle of the Cold War. The long standoff between nuclear powers, where the only defence was the threat of mutually assured destruction.
Born from a need to counteract the threat. Now that such a threat, for threats have been made. Now that the enemy has shown that they, and in sailing so close, in having simply sailed, that they could even consider that their so-called threats, that they might launch, and in so launching, as such, a clear need has arisen, and in its rising, in its staying up, a need to negate, to nullify, to rule out by our having in place, by our simply having.
J.O. Morgan reading Assurances, which he recorded exclusively for RNIB Talking Books. And afterwards, he joined me in the RNIB Connect radio studio.
Assurances is set in the early years of the Cold War, when the nuclear deterrent, which we still have now, the role was taken up by the RAF. And my father was part of that division when he was in the RAF. So it was something that I grew up aware of, even though he wasn't doing that job anymore. It's been in the back of my mind for a long, long time, this curious state of being highly trained for a role which you really don't want to carry out. You know, you have to carry the bombs around in the air, but you really don't want to drop them. But you'd have to be willing to actually carry your orders out. And yet most of the time, most of your job would be waiting. So it's this state of waiting that really intrigued me. And I decided that the best way to approach it as a subject would be as a theme and variations, much like the musical form, you know, the theme being the nuclear deterrent itself, and then all these imagined variations of what might come from that state. So a lot of the pieces in there, because we know the bomb was never actually dropped in reality, so I was able to sort of create circumstances where something goes wrong or everything goes right, or even in the voice of the bomb itself in one part of the book.
Now, we'll come back to the voice of the bomb in a moment. And I suppose this is to do with the end of the Cold War, but as you see, we still have that nuclear deterrent. But the concept of the four-minute warning has sort of dropped out of the public consciousness.
89 was the Berlin Wall, and then 1991 probably was the end of the Cold War. If there was an official date, I don't know. I'm not really an expert on it, but it is, you're absolutely right, it is strange. It's sort of, people aren't aware. I mean, people are aware of Trident and the various things that are going on, but it's out of sight, out of mind. I suppose with the RAF as well, we're not necessarily aware of what the military's doing, but there were far more tensions during those years. Perhaps it was talked about more. Of course, now we have other nuclear things that are in the news, and Korea and America and Russia as well. But it's a different scenario to some extent.
Not that 4 minutes allows them the means to do much. A cry of evacuation would be empty of any such hope. Go where? Under what? For how long? All they have left is to order the counterattack.
Now, when I first approached you about reading the RNIB audio version yourself, after the Costa win and also being interviewed by my colleague Red Sail, let's just say you were very keen to read it.
Yeah, I certainly wanted to have a go at it, because it's, you know, for a whole book, it's different from a collection of poetry where you can read each individual poem. This is a single work all the way through, but still, as a book, it's only 48 pages. And with that sort of condensed language, you can't sort of read it through just straight in a single voice, because it's quite complicated, it's quite dense. And it's just that I have this ideas in my head of how the particular lines, all the rhythms and particular things that I've put in there. Anyone could read it out loud and make something of it. It was just to give me the opportunity to try and present it how I'd want it to be heard. So that was really the only thing. I don't know whether I did make a good job of it. I think it's probably... Yeah, I don't want the voices that I do in it to be gimmicky as such. It's just to try and have a tonal shift between different perspectives in the work. That was something that's important to me if I'm performing out loud at a festival, say.
Is that also part of the writing process, reading it to yourself?
I do at some point, really, because when you've gone over and over the words so many times, you have to get them to stand out to yourself. So reading it out loud becomes a new way to approach it, and you start hearing it differently, and then you can react to that and think, oh, I can change that syllable here and this there, fine tuning.
Jingler has been an overall rise in popularity of poetry.
I do hear that. I've certainly read articles or heard various programs saying that more people are reading it and the sales have been up. From what I know, that seems to be tied in with social media platforms, because poetry, or certainly lyric poetry, the sort of shorter form, what's generally thought of as poetry in these days, is perfectly suited to that medium. It's short, you can fit it on a page, you can read it in an instant or in our busy life. And it sort of makes sense in that way that people have utilised that or have gone with that and made it work to their advantage. It's much easier writing a single page poem than writing a whole novel. You know, you can get an idea, you can put it down, and that's that. That's your work done. I'm not saying it's easy, but then when it comes to my works, they're longer, so that it is more like writing a novel. It takes about the same amount of time.
Assurances has both passages in verse and in prose. What made you decide what parts to write in what style?
The prose sections are interesting. I that was something that really gave me that approach to it. Always with any book I'm doing, it's sort of, okay, I know the subject, I know what I want to say, but how do I do it? Well, you know, what form is it going to get? And it's not always in poetry that I will do things in. The pieces that look like they're prose on the page, they're actually still written with poetic meter and various other poetic techniques in them. But I wanted them to look like prose. I wanted them to have that feel of the flow of prose. And the reason I chose that was those sections within the work all have a sort of, a bit like a vox pop, like mini interviews with people that you're just catching. So, and I wanted this sort of slight rambly language in there. I wanted people to be perhaps saying something and then almost contradicting themselves, because within the nuclear deterrent, within what you have or would have to do, I felt that there'd be that sort of denial. You sort of don't really want to face up to what you'd have to be killing millions and millions of innocent people. So you have to justify it to yourself, and yet not. So that's where all the contradictions came in. So I wanted this looser language in a way, in this sort of almost stream of consciousness. And I felt these little prose sections. And then there was another thing that I did with the work, parts, because those would other, if it was just those throughout the work, it would be quite strange. So I'm always trying to break things up and insert one type of text into another type of text. So there are these bits that are in brackets, or I call them, or call those sections parentheticals, because they're like just a little aside. So it's a little other voice interrupting the main voice of just having a thought, and sometimes they're a bit more dreamy. Hopefully you'll hear in the recording I've done that they have that sense of slight wistfulness, kind of, oh, maybe this or maybe that. And they don't necessarily tie into what the sort of interview voice is saying, but there'll be some sort of parallel going on. And again, that's why I do it in different voices, so to make a clear distinction between these two parts. Otherwise, it would be very difficult to follow. So, yeah, so it's, I always take the form of how I do it from the subject itself. It's always the subject and the matter and what it is will always inform how I do it. But it's usually really difficult working out what that how is going to be. That takes me the longest time.
These little sections, it almost sounds like you're overhearing a snatch of someone else's conversation during a conversation.
Yeah. No, that's the sort of thing I was going for, yes.
The bomb itself is no fancy rocket. Can't be simply pointed and let loose. It will not follow a scent of its own accord. It is sightless and flightless and witless and fat. Must have its hand held all the way, and only let go for those few final seconds. The one sure thing it knows how to do is fall. The last land-hugging stretch, near supersonic through the thicker airs, sweeping awake over forest tops, like fingers trailed through water, rattling the church spire's copper cross, spinning the farm's weather vane. A pregnant approach. The speed of the carrier being the speed of the bomb. Floated soft and belly held and effortless.
Now, getting back to the voice of the bomb, are you a fan of the John Carpenter movie Dark Star?
That's true, yes. Let there be light. Yes. I hadn't thought of that. That's a good one, yes. And God.
My juiciness is packed in tight, preserved, thick-skinned. I won't go off till I am given to go off. Oh, my creator.
No, but there's the voice of the bomb in my one. That is true, to get inside the mind of it. And there is a similarity, isn't there? I suppose that's a curious thing. I often find this, and there's... you know, I read something else or I hear something else and there's that kind of slight shock in my system of, oh, someone else has done that. You know, have I coughed? But then I have to sort of think, well, if somebody else was to approach the same subject, obviously they're going to come up in similar ways. And actually, after that initial shock, it's fascinating to kind of go, oh, I see there is a similarity, but there's also a difference as well. And it was like a war poem I did with Anglo-Saxon being invaded by the Vikings. And I was reading another work that came out at around the same time, which is also a war poem. And there were just a few phrases that came up in his work that made me go, oh, that's similar to mine. Of course, neither of us could have read the other one's work because they were both published at the same time. And again, you think, of course, if you've got a poet looking at war, they're going to use similar allusions. That makes sense.
The one considers its own variation as similarly correct. It won't be ignored. Strength of convictions combined should not be allowed to counter that of the individual. A truth cannot be arrived at through numbers alone. All three agree that, in this singular instance, likelihood must give way to perception. What was deemed improbable is pronounced irrelevant, the possibility of any one moment being only as real as the chosen expectations of another. All three agree that, in such a state of uncertainty, the safest solution is not to act at all, or else to find a better way in which to run the tests, the system having in some manner already failed.
And there is another part in Assurances where it's three code-breaking or code-receiving machines that are all sort of deciding. It's a form of diplomacy, the idea that you would have three machines all receiving the orders so that if one broke down, at least the other two would potentially get it right. And then there's this sort of argument, because the one who's got it wrong, it believes it's got it right. So how can you tell? And they sort of have this strange sort of logical conclusion that none of them should do anything because they can't trust any of the data that's come in. And essentially, nothing gets done, the order doesn't get relayed, and the bomb doesn't get launched, which in one way is a good thing, but yeah, it messes up the system of the nuclear deterrent. There are lots of places in the book where the idea of the deterrent is foiled either by humans not wanting to perform their role or by machines deciding not to, or and then of course there are other times when everything goes according to plan and the bomb gets dropped. But that's only sort of hinted at in the background.
Assurances by J.O. Morgan, winner of the Costa Poetry Award, is available in audio in the RNIB Talking Books Library. For more information, head to rniblibrary.com or call the RNIB helpline on 0303 123 9999. That's 0303 123 9999.
And now let's return to Hannah Lowe, the winner of this year's Costa Book Award for the books of her life.
Hannah, was there a book that you read as a youngster that made you fall in love with reading or want to become a writer?
I think one of the books I absolutely loved as a child was Goodnight, Mr. Tom. And it's the story of a young boy during the Second World War who's evacuated, who comes from very difficult circumstances, and he's taken care of by a much older man who's had his own tragic life circumstances. And it's about this beautiful, unorthodox bond between two people. It's set against the backdrop of World War II, the Blitz and London. And there must have been an awful lot of historical research that went into that book. But the storytelling of the book is just fantastic. So I would recommend that book to anyone that's got, you know, a young reader at home.
"Sorry, mister," he kept repeating fearfully. "Sorry, Mr. Tom." Tom just grunted in his usual manner. He pulled Willie's clothes from off the line and handed them to him. "Too hot for socks," he muttered. "Leave 'em off."
"I can't go without me socks," cried Willie in alarm. "Please, Mr. Tom, I can't."
"Why?" Tom snorted.
"Me legs," he whispered.
He didn't want everyone to see the marks of his sins. Tom sighed and threw the socks on the table. They had breakfast by the open window.
Christopher Saul narrating Goodnight, Mr. Tom by Michelle Magourian, which is available from the RNIB Library.
And is there a book that on a rainy day you'd like to curl up with and reread?
Andrea Levy's Small Island. I think that book is such an absolute triumph, again, in handling research and storytelling. Interestingly, it has the same kind of setting. Well, it's set during the Second World War, just after. It's about post-war Caribbean migration, and it has four narrators, two of whom are white and English, two of whom are a newly arrived couple from Jamaica to London. And it's about race and racism and the legacies of empire, but it's also about human connection across those barriers of race and social class. It's so, so moving. And Andrea Levy tragically died a couple of years ago. She's such an amazing writer. I would recommend that book.
"The moment I saw him, the papa I carried slipped from my grasp, its orange-pink flesh smashing open against my foot, splattering my leg with the pebble-black seeds. He rode a bicycle, the frame too small to take his long legs, forced his knees to bend like a frog's. Unfamiliar with the machine, he wobbled dangerously, ringing the bell to warn people of his hazardous approach. I ran so I would not lose him, born on a euphoria that flew me through the street while the sticky pulp from the papa seeped into my shoe. And I called, 'Michael, wait!' Many heads looked, but not his. Raising himself from the bicycle seat, he stood to pedal faster."
Small Island by Andrea Levy, which is narrated by Eddie Connor, Anika Lee Wright and Joan Walker, and is available from the RNIB Library.
And finally, is there a book that you've read recently that you'd like to share with the listeners?
Well, so much of my reading these days is linked to my work, and I do a lot of teaching of memoir and life writing. So that's what I tend to read the most of these days, is memoir. And recently I read Vivian Gornick's Fierce Attachments. It's a memoir of a mother and daughter from a Jewish family in New York, and it moves back and forwards in time. Again, it's about human connection. They don't get on. And there's many depictions of the kind of tension in their relationship. It's all about men and sex and how women's connections can be divided sort of because of patriarchy, because of marriage. But it moves forward in time when the narrator is a woman, I think, around my age, I'm in my mid-40s, walking the streets of New York with her now elderly mother, and then reflecting on the past and sort of finding a connection despite decades and decades of tension and misunderstanding. It's a brilliantly written memoir where there's a real sense of transformation of the characters in it.
Unfortunately, Fierce Attachments, a memoir by Vivian Gornick, isn't currently available in audio. But here's a clip narrated by Jill Fox.
I lived in that tenement between the ages of 6 and 21. There were 20 apartments, 4 to a floor, and all I remember is a building full of women. I hardly remember the men at all. They were everywhere, of course, husbands, fathers, brothers, but I remember only the women. And I remember them all crude, like Mrs. Drucker, or fierce, like my mother. They never spoke as though they knew who they were, understood the bargain they had struck with life, but they often acted as though they knew. Shrewd, volatile, unlettered, they performed on a Dreiserian scale. There would be years of apparent calm, then suddenly an outbreak of panic and wildness, 2 or 3 lives scarred, perhaps ruined, and the turmoil would subside.
Well, Hannah Lowe, thank you so much for being a guest on the show and for sharing your obvious passion for reading with the listeners. And many congratulations again on winning the 2021 Costa Poetry Award.
Thank you, Red. It was lovely to talk to you.
That's it for this week's special episode of Read On. Thanks to all our guests, to producer Hannah, and particularly to Robert Kirkwood for putting this retrospective together. Read On will be back at the same time next week, and you can always subscribe to the podcast by searching your favourite provider for Read On, the audiobook show. And why not follow us on Twitter? I'm at RedSail, which is RedSzell, and Robert is at Talking_Books. Farewell until next week, and don't forget to read on.